Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents How to Begin When Your World is Ending, a spiritual field guide to joy despite everything by Molly Finney Basquette. Read by Molly Finney Basquette. To all the people in all of my churches and throughout my life who have been God with skin on. Jesus said, "You ought always to pray and not to faint. Do not pray for easy lives. Pray to be stronger people. Do not pray for tasks equal to your powers, but for power equal to your tasks. Then the doing of your work will be no miracle. You will be the miracle. Every day you will wonder at yourself and at the richness of life which has come to you by the grace of God." Julia Esquivel. Prologue. There are very few emergencies. If you are unlucky, or that is to say, an ordinary human, you have emergencies. A thing you found in your teenager's room, the lump you found in the shower, the phone call that changes everything. When I first heard the shocking news that I had a ball of cancer growing sneakily and silently inside of me, the first call I made was to my husband. By tacit agreement, I'd been the unflappable one for the previous decade of our lives, but this time he agreed to let me do most of the freaking out. It made that particular emergency a lot more bearable. I first learned unflappability from a Robertson Davies novel in which a village parson is called to the scene of a murder in the middle of the night. He doesn't race to the scene wild-haired, with his PJs peeking out of his raincoat. He takes time to dress, wash, and compose himself before he gets there. He knows that whomever he meets at the other end will need his dignity, empathy, and strength, even if he would have to fake it in the face of the calamitous. When I became a pastor, I took this role to heart, which doesn't mean I always get it right. There was the time I raced to the ER to support a mom fleeing partner violence in the middle of the night. My car had gotten broken into earlier that day, and there was still broken glass everywhere. The exhausted mother and her two kids had to wait in the dismal, cold 1 a.m. hospital parking lot while I sweatily cleaned off the seat before driving them to a hotel for the night. Then there was the time I cried my eyes out in public on the church lawn after a particularly fierce church fight, my heart broken at news earlier that week that my only brother had died by violence. Broken afresh by the pettiness and awfulness of anxious church people facing big decisions and putting me in their crosshairs, I wept. There was a time I, a newly minted mother, brought my newborn to a restorative justice circle between a confirmed pedophile and the parents of the child he had sexually assaulted. I couldn't line up childcare, and I thought I could manage it the way I'd handled so many other demanding, complex things in my life. Whether it was the massive denial or just the cluelessness of being a new parent, I can't say. My boy fussed, my boobs geysered ever-flowing streams, and I tried to low-key nurse with awkward beginning breastfeeding skills, holding back the tears during one of the most devastating conversations I've ever participated in. These are exceptions, I think. I expect some notes from people in the know. Mostly over the years, I've learned to pause when there are big feelings or big doings around me. I check in with God, who reminds me that whatever I'm about to face is not quite the emergency I imagine, and I take my cues from there. That's what people in crisis need from God and God's customer service reps, those of us offering first-line spiritual support. Someone recently devastated by the unimaginable looks into our face as they would look into a mirror. What they hope to see is that they will get through this. And they will. We have, all of us, so far survived everything we've been through to one degree or another. We know because we are still here. As for those who didn't survive, those who have died by their own hand or another's, by the villains of cancer or other catastrophes, my take is a question. Do we really know they haven't survived too? More on that later. When I began writing this book, I was sheltering in place along with 40 million other Californians, as well as people in every other state and around the world. We were hiding out not from a mass shooter or an alien invasion, but a microscopic virus similar in design to the common cold that we were told could kill up to 3% of the global population. Maybe this qualified as an emergency? 8 weeks into the shelter order, the biggest problem in our house was that my husband was rationing toilet paper. I told him he could decide how many squares per week I could have when he grew a vagina. Meanwhile, India, a country with 1 billion people, went into lockdown with only 4 hours' notice. Not enough time to purchase rice and beans, let alone toilet paper. This pandemic changed all of our lives. It also ended many of our lives. My biggest problem wasn't really the TP. Besides the expected anxieties about getting sick, my asthmatic children getting sick, or my elderly dad dying alone, I was sick at heart because I couldn't do my job the way I wanted to. Prudence and the internet dictated that with my skill set, the most heroic thing I could do was stay home and binge watch something called Tiger King. I craved a larger purpose. My arms ached from the hugs bottled up inside them. I wanted to get back to work, helping people make meaning, if not sense, from the terrible things that happened to them. And I wanted to be able to do it in person, with a hand on their arm and with a gaze directly into their eyes. Because as much as I believe in God, and as much as I have felt the purely spiritual presence of God throughout my life, I need God to show up with skin on at regular intervals. We need a solid someone who can help us feel the ground beneath our feet when fear or anxiety or anger are spinning out of control, a someone to restore us to sanity, generosity, patience, and peace. We need a someone who teaches us how to do it for someone else. Otherwise, we might die alone in our billionaire bunkers or MMA fighting in aisle 3 over the last container of disinfecting wipes. I wanted to get back to work as this someone for others because I've had so many someones do it for me. When I was young, everything felt like an emergency. My mother had incapacitating clinical depression and anxiety. My stepfather was a mentally ill alcoholic. My loving yet conflict-averse father followed my mother's whims about visitation and custody, hoping to stay on her good side, afraid of losing access to us entirely. I often felt like I was on my own, fending for myself. I was on my own, but not alone. Angels accompanied me unawares. My Head Start teachers in preschool, the public librarian who let me read the second grade books in first grade, my middle school drama teacher, Mr. Casey. They all made safe new worlds for me to escape into when mine was too bleak. I took shelter in grades and achievement, a trusty launchpad to rocket me out of the poverty and chaos that often dogged my early life. But even with angels beside me and a path before me, my emotions careened wildly. Until I turned 28, I pretty much cried nearly every day of my life. At 28, the river of tears finally slowed to a seasonal creek. The change came about because, in short, by then I had been loved well by enough someones that I could become a someone more frequently for others. By my late 20s, I had found a series of best friends who are among the strongest people I've ever known. Their love enabled me to become my own solid self. Their love taught me how to be independent. By that time, I had also made a casual friend who became an ardent lover and eventually a lifelong partner. Through many efficacious battles during the early years of our courtship and marriage, he helped me grow into a person who could sit tight through a fight and learn to bend without breaking. He was the someone who taught me how to be interdependent. And he was the someone who I called with my lump news, who took on the Robertson-Davies pastor role so I could be among those who wail, bereft. When I graduated from seminary, I wasn't sure I was ready to be a pastor because I knew people would have certain expectations of me, and I didn't feel ready to bear that weight. I was worried about splitting into a public self who held it together and had all the answers, and a private self who still fell apart on the regular. I needed to make sure my own self and stuff were managed so I wouldn't bleed out on people who needed me to meet them with focus and respect in their moment of need. It was time to do unto others as so many someones had done unto me. It was time to help them through the disasters in their lives, to remind them that the root word in emergency is emerge. When I say there are very few emergencies, I don't mean truly terrible things don't happen. I mean that if we can do things like breathe, delay gratification, feel our feelings in real time, keep ourselves from too much impulsivity, and reach for the right practice or people, we can survive. We can emerge through disaster. If we can't make sense of what's happening to us and around us, we can at least make meaning eventually. And with spiritual hindsight, many of our disasters might turn out to be Holy Spirit portals, the way God gets in. Sometimes disaster creates a rupture with a reality that wasn't quite working. The woman who fled her home in the night is now in a new apartment, has a permanent restraining order, and is starting college alongside her 18-year-old son. The pedophile did a 5-year prison term where he took advantage of every class and program and Bible study there to help him understand his affliction and gain empathy for his victims so that he would never reoffend. Later, he moved to a community with other sex offenders in recovery so he could have long-term support and accountability. The boy who I nursed just left home to make his way through a country of virus, back to the place where he was born, to be birthed again into young adulthood. My church and I are still emerging from our own emergency, a fire that claimed most of our church campus and drove us into deep disagreement and anxiety about our future. But recently, we sent mail-in ballots to every member, asking them to approve the tearing up of part of our parking lot in order to build 50 units of affordable housing, one small but mighty effort to address the Bay Area housing crisis. If the church had not burned down, we never would have taken this idea seriously, and we probably would not have brought it to a vote if coronavirus and sheltering in place had not revealed what really matters. In the hardest way, we have learned that church is not a building, but a people. People who are called to be someones for others. And my husband held up his part of the bargain to keep his shit together so I could fall all the way apart. I have had 10 years of clean CAT scans since that phone call to tell him the terrible news. No evidence of disease, even if lots of other evidence from the cancer and chemo remains after bombing my life 10 years ago. This is a book about the someones I have pastored through some of the hardest things life can throw our way. It's a book about my own cancer odyssey and a tapestry of other stories about trying to face life on life's terms. Because some of us long to feel that God is good all the time, even if the world is definitely not. It's a book for anyone who craves confirmation that even while God may not be the great puppet master to make it all come right, someone is present in our lives, loves us very much, and can provide strength and meaning. It's a book for anyone who wants to press the bruise of the reality that this sweet, hard, wonderful gig of being human is going to come to an end someday, maybe sooner than we expect. People training for the ministry inevitably take a seminary course called Systematic Theology about the nature and being of God, the concepts of sin, salvation, heaven, hell, grace, redemption, resurrection, prayer, and more. At progressive seminaries, we see all of these through the lenses of structural racism and sexism, colonialism and liberation theology. As at an eye exam, when the optometrist flips the lens, we say, "Now we see more clearly." Yep, more clearly now. The goal of the course is to arrange the religious truths we are learning into a self-consistent whole without gaps, helping us better teach and pastor the people in our care during times of struggle or crisis. In a classroom setting, it is a blueprint for a boat of sorts, but we don't yet know if the blueprint will create a seaworthy vessel. The only way to know is to test the boat in real-world conditions out on the open sea. This book is about testing the seaworthiness of the vessel. The blueprints came from the class, but God and I built this ship together and tested it through some of the very hardest things that can happen to humans. As a parish minister, I encounter people at their most vulnerable, aching, confused, and frail. I have pastored people convicted of rape and murder, those living with treatment-resistant depression, PTSD, unremitting eating disorders, domestic and sexual abuse survivors, those suffering through pregnancy loss and the death of a child, divorce, or those fleeing violence in another country, and those coming out as queer to fundamentalist parents or discerning their true gender. Every one of those experiences tested seaworthiness. Every one made that boat and God more real. Every one of those experiences forced me to throw overboard the things that threatened to sink us and showed me where to find a life buoy I could throw to save life, give hope, banish fear, and help someone find their way back from despair or toward redemption. Life as it stands will keep trying to shake us up or smash our boat onto the rocks. This is not because God is an asshole. It's because nature throws novel viruses and earthquakes and worse into our path. It's also because humans are inventive and wonderful, but then we dream up things that ruin lives, like crystal meth, hypercapitalism, and high-waisted jeans. Not a good look for anyone. If we think we are safe, we are wrong. Nothing can insulate us from loss. But safe was never the point. There are fates worse than death, like not ever really living. If you are lucky, you are currently between emergencies. Maybe you've had a rare chance to get off the roller coaster entirely. Your legs have just stopped shaking and you think, "I'm never doing that again." You're sitting in the sun, eating something delicious and terrible for you. Fried dough, a corn dog, a caramel apple that will pull out your crown. Enjoy the moment. It's not going to last. And if you're in the middle of a fast-moving or slow-motion emergency, a sick toddler, a wayward teen, a relationship at a crossroads, a dance with addiction, a mental health crisis, only time will tell if it really was a true emergency. Because with the right kind of attention, ruptures can reveal us, emerge us, and help us evolve faster than any virus. By the time you are listening to this, we are hopefully past the worst of the global pandemic. You, like God, are living in the future and have divine hindsight. You have grieved your dead, and your grief with any grace has softened into blessed memory. Maybe the pandemic will have proven to be a portal to universal paid sick leave, universal basic income, universal health care, and universal earth care. Millions may have died, but they will not have died in vain. Because God is not an asshole. And while God didn't send the disaster, God for damn sure will use it. Chapter 1. God didn't send the disaster, but she will use it. Every day your body makes new cells, epithelial cells, dendritic cells, neutrophils, platelets, and 200 other varieties. And every day, when your body is making new cells, one of them, often more than one, goofs up in dividing. That cell turns into a cancer cell. It's a trash cell serving no purpose beyond making more and more and more of itself, a natural narcissist. Lucky for you, your body then sends a white blood cell known as a natural killer cell to take out the trash. Until the day when your body misses one. Every day, things in life go wrong and then suddenly go right again, often without our even noticing. But sometimes things go wrong and keep going wrong. When bad things happen to us, our reptilian brains seek the shelter of easy answers and black and white thinking, looking for a culprit. God! Often the first, most convenient target. In January 2010, a 7.0 earthquake struck Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, killing 250,000 people and displacing another 1.5 million. The city I lived in at the time, Somerville, Massachusetts, has a sizable Haitian population. A prayer vigil was arranged in the high school gym, and I was invited to pray. As I waited my turn, I listened to pastor after pastor lament that God was punishing Haiti for some sin they had committed. They weren't even blaming God. They were blaming themselves. It's what victims sometimes do, if only to take back some control over the narrative of chaos. Not to mention, it is what a racist, sexist, classist, and homophobic society has taught them to do. You shouldn't have been jogging in that neighborhood. You asked for it by wearing that skirt. You must be lazy or stupid if you can't get ahead in America. Not today, Satan. Throwing out my notes, I asked the Holy Spirit for a new prayer. Holy One, I know you didn't send this disaster, but I know you want to use it. Haiti has been the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere since its people became the first to win freedom from their enslavers and the rest of the world abandoned it. God, richer countries have turned a blind eye to Haiti's suffering time and time again. But we can't look away now. Use this earthquake to break the hard hearts of the many of us who have forgotten that Haiti is our neighbor. 3 months after I prayed that prayer, I was suddenly diagnosed with cancer. They found the tumor in my left lung, of all places, an errant golf ball lodged there inside my ribcage for who knows how long, as I breathed in, breathed out, oblivious to the ticking time bomb. It was a chance to test the earthquake prayer under very personal circumstances. The idea that God didn't send the disaster, but she would use it. She would take advantage of the rupture and the pain, great stimulants, to make all kinds of things happen that might not have otherwise. And not just to change and reveal me to myself in essential ways, but also to shape the many lives that touched mine. Because God is like that, doing more than one thing at the same time. Obviously, I lived. And spoiler alert, cancer radically reoriented me toward life, even saved my life in ways I will never completely be able to understand. I can say this because I got to live. I'm writing this from the future. I might have quite different things to say about cancer if it had killed me, cut short my marriage and my calling, and orphaned my children. Not that everything turned out all right in the end. Life goes on in equilibrium and disequilibrium. Good things happen, thorny problems resolve, and then if you're lucky, you live long enough for life to get hard again. Since surviving cancer, I have also survived my brother's murder, suicide attempts by two people I helped raise, my now 15-year-old's clinical depression, and the ongoing roller coaster of my 19-year-old's flirtations with things that might kill him if we don't do it first. Also, a cross-country move, a major fire, and a Donald Trump presidency. Fist bump. When new members join my church, they go through an initiation. We invite them to a house in the Berkeley Hills for a festive evening of crepes, sparkling beverages, and spiritual stories as the sun sets over the bay. The experience of telling a circle of random strangers who, to outward appearances, have nothing in common, how God has shown up in their life or left them hanging, strips them bare. There are always tears, sometimes deep sobbing, shared grief, furious nodding, along with lots of laughter and gallows humor. We leave knowing we have shared a foxhole for a few hours. Before the stories are told, and as we sit down with full plates teetering on our laps, I tell them, "Your faith story is not your church story. It's much bigger than that and might only be a little bit about church. It is also probably not a sweet, easy story." I guide them through the process and offer ideas. To figure out how to tell it, you might use geographic motifs like the Bible does, a mountaintop experience, the valley of the shadow of death, the valley of dry bones, a great flood, wandering in the desert, a shipwreck, the getting eaten then barfed up by a great beast, or the testing time alone in the wilderness with only angels and demons for company. Your story might be relational, about makeups, breakups, significant mentors, deaths, and other losses. Your story might be an incarnational story of bodily illness, recovery, wounds, scars, and resurrections. Every story is unique, but through years of listening to stories told in faith and vulnerability, I see common themes. One particular tale comes up again and again. As a precocious 7-year-old in Sunday school, 13-year-old in confirmation class, or 19-year-old in Bible college, they started asking their teachers uncomfortable theological questions. Questions like, "How could a good God condemn people to eternal suffering in hell? What do you do about all the contradictions in the Bible or the scriptural rules we conveniently ignore? What would Jesus have to say about how institutional Christianity has made racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, xenophobia, and a weird, creepy America First patriotism part of its operating system?" And while we're on the subject, if God is really in charge of all this, how come children die hungry or get sex trafficked? How is it possible that a man who cheats on, abandons, or kills his wife can be redeemed by God, but a woman who leaves her abusive marriage can't take communion? And how dare God wipe out hundreds of thousands of people with a single tsunami, earthquake, or plague? With few exceptions, our new members tell us how they began to critique the party line. How they move from what the theologian Marcus Borg called pre-critical naivete into a more mature critical thinking posture. The stories include how their teachers, bent on keeping control, couldn't handle the questions and usually kicked them out. After that, one of a few things happened to them. Sometimes they surveyed their other options and found a more progressive Christian church where they could ask all the questions and have all the feelings and nobody would raise an eyebrow. Often they found their way down new spiritual paths that didn't leave such a bad taste in their mouths, Buddhism, Hinduism, or Judaism, where they could read a lot of the same sacred texts without the Christian supersessionism and fundamentalist malpractice. Most often, they gave up religion as a bad deal, shook the dust off their sandals, and left the church entirely, becoming functional agnostics or atheists. Sunday morning turned into a haven for jammies and the comic section, or vigorous communion with God through nature and high-tech athleisure wear. But some were too stubborn to leave their conservative churches. They refused to go quietly, but they also refused to submit to teachings that made no logical or moral sense. So they stayed, and some of them made their own sense out of what they were hearing. Like Ashley, a young mom who recently joined our church. She was raised in Oklahoma by a scientist dad and a religious mom whose faith compelled the whole family to church. As a teen, Ashley started going to her friend's more evangelical church because they had better snacks, cute boys, and a really charismatic youth pastor who played guitar. Her new church provided the comfort of ritual and belonging, and a strong container that defined and made sense of the world through the terrifying, disorienting teen years. But as Ashley learned in ever greater detail just who was welcomed into the country club of God's grace and approved.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?